And that's when Charge B happened. It was a casual conversation with Rajaraman, right? Where he told me we're looking for somebody, you know, who can run the finance or set up the finance function for us. Because the 60 people then, as part of the conversation, I told both Rajaraman and Krish that I'd also like to work very closely with the product team, right? In terms of trying to see how, you know, from a finance user standpoint, what knowledge base can be made available. If you can hire smart people, right, who can do the right things for you, who can do all of the day-to-day job for you, and then you can enable yourself to go to the next level, then I think that really helps the finance leader to then grow. When we came out of the pandemic, our numbers were like growing, you know, almost double, right, in terms of how we were doing year on year. That paved the way for us to then become extremely confident in terms of how well we can execute.
Hey, we are back with the next episode in Copa Talks, the ultimate CFO podcast brought to you by Blue Copa. Here, we bring you unfiltered access to conversations with veteran finance leaders covering key milestones and challenges in their journey through stories. Joining us today is Karthik, the VP of Finance at ChargeB, a leading subscription billing platform. Karthik comes with a rich experience in finance domain, having worked with TCS, FSS, Olam, and now ChargeB. Unanimously regarded as very humble, Karthik is certainly a people favorite at ChargeB. Come as we explore the art of staying calm, playing the long game, and how to hire right with Karthik. Without any delay, let's get into the chat. Hey Karthik, welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Great. So we'd love to know more about you first. Why don't you talk about Karthik as a kid and his interest in finance?
Yeah, sure. So, so interestingly, finance was not something that I wanted to grow up being, right? So when I completed my 10th grade, I wanted to kind of look out for which is the easiest subject that I can actually fare well on, right? not very good at science. Was good at maths, right? So which is when I decided, okay, let me take up the commerce group, right? Because I heard that amongst all of the groups, you know, being computer science, biology, commerce group probably was the easiest, right, to get cracking on. So that's how I did my 11th and 12th grade was when, you know, I started pursuing the commerce group. And after I completed my 12th grade, in fact, I got pretty good marks in my 12th grade.
Mm-hmm.
That's when this conversation started, right, with one of the auditors. You know, I was trying to find out what I should be doing after that, right? Which precisely meant that, you know, when I started my 11th grade, I had no plans of being a chartered accountant or pursuing something in accounting.
Wow.
So after I completed my 12th grade, an intriguing conversation happened with one practicing auditor. Right. He looked at my marks and then he asked me this question in terms of would it make sense, you know, why don't you think about pursuing chartered accountancy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Until then, I had very little knowledge about what chartered accountancy was all about. Of course, I'd heard about, you know, how people had excelled, how hard it was, how difficult it was to crack and all of that. So I was a little skeptical to start with, but I think that auditor gave me a lot of confidence. He told me that you've done well, you've fared well in your board exams. So all that you have to do is just repeat that performance three more times, right? Three more times, your foundation, intermediate, final levels, and then you should get going. And that's how, you know, I actually made an entry into that foray of being a chartered accountant and then, you know, getting into the finance part of it. Very interesting journey. 3 years that I pursued. I always thought, I mean, if it's not for this, I'll obviously go to a B school and pursue an MBA is how I, you know, started getting deep into this curriculum of chartered accountancy. But it so happened that I was able to clear all of those three levels, the first attempt itself. And then in 2003, I got qualified as a chartered accountant.
God, I think what he predicted wasn't wrong, the auditor.
Yeah, it was actually good, right? I think what he predicted made a lot of sense because my preparation was exactly the same, right? In terms of how I'd prepared for my 12th board is how I'd prepared for all of the three levels when I was pursuing CA. So I think that conversation was really good, really helpful and gave me a lot of confidence. So it worked perfectly well, right?
So that could have been a great external validation or a realization, right? What was the internal
sort of drive that pushed Karthik, you know, finance is probably what I am destined to do or I would love doing. So was there any sort of an incident or something that you could share with us?
So I think what happened was when I was pursuing my 11th grade and 12th grade, so in addition to being good at maths, I also discovered that it was good in accounting as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Probably because of its close affinity to mathematics. So I naturally started developing an interest for accounting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I still remember the conversation that I had with my accounting teacher, right, in my 12th grade. And every time he used to give me a problem to solve in accounting, mm-hmm. he used to find a way to get it solved pretty quickly, right? I mean, obviously, there are accounting standards and all that that are applicable. Yeah. But then in terms of getting to the answer accurately, right, it didn't take me much time, which means I found out that I had a natural inclination to prepare a balance sheet, you know, prepare a profit and loss statement and all that. So
yeah,
I think that kind of paved the way for me to think through when, you know, the suggestion was made, right, in terms of pursuing chartered accountancy, that if accounting is something that you're good at, you know, if something that you feel naturally you're good at, why don't you, you know, go ahead and pursue, right? So,
got it.
That's how it all came together.
Great. And in 2003, you know, how did TCS happen? How did FSS Olam happen? And how did you end up at ChargeBee? Would love to know that story bit.
Yeah. So, after I completed my CA final papers, right, because I completed in the first attempt, we had a campus interview, which was held within the Institute of Chartered Accountants of India campus.
Mm-hmm.
And Tata Sons, Birla, all of the big names, right, were there as part of the campus interview. And I got selected as part of the Tata Sons interview, right? In fact, mm-hmm. also got selected as part of another company, which was Ernst & Young, then also had an offer with PwC, KPMG. So quite a few offers that I had on hand. Birla Soft was another company that was doing well at that time. But I think it finally came down to me trying to see, you know, which company I want to join amongst all of this. So there again, I needed somebody to guide me, right? and thankfully, I found one of my uncle's friends who's working in TCS. Mm-hmm. He's a very close neighbor of my uncle. And I had a chance to speak to him. And I told him that, you know, these are the offers that I have. And which of these did you do you recommend? I think that's the point in time when TCS was actually going public. TCS was setting itself for an IPO in the year 2004, right, 2003, 2004. And so he told me the best opportunity for you is to join Tata Sons, right? I mean, the interview was by Tata Sons, but there's no guarantee that you'll get into TCS. But he told me that Tata Sons being a large conglomerate, right, you can get placed any of the Tata Group companies, and all of the Tata Group companies are very traditional, unique in their business model. So it'll be a great experience and lay the right foundations for you to, you know, later on build your career.
Yeah.
I took that advice, right? There was a training management program that happened in Pune.
Mm-hmm.
Attended that program. I was a little reluctant to actually move out of Chennai at that point in time. But so happened that I actually landed myself in Mumbai. Spent a couple of years in TCS in Mumbai. Was part of that team which was closely involved, right, in terms of preparing ourselves to go public. A couple of subsidiaries I was handling, one being the Singapore group of subsidiaries, the other being an India-based subsidiary based out of New Delhi. So that's how that journey started, right? It was actually very interesting. I landed myself in Mumbai. Mumbai was a great place, right? Initial apprehensions were there, but then once I got started with Mumbai, I started liking that place, right?
Nice.
So, yeah, I think the experience that I got that those couple of years in Mumbai, both from a personal standpoint as well as from a professional standpoint, was really enhancing, right? And that opportunity then paved the way for me to go to Singapore, because the fact that I was handling the Asia-Pacific subsidiaries, the vice president of finance called me for a discussion. He said, since you're handling the Asia-Pacific subsidiaries, there is an opportunity that has come up in Singapore. Why don't you join the financial controller who is about to be recruited there? And then both of you can work together in terms of running the finance and accounts for that subsidiary. So that's how my journey transitioned from Mumbai to Singapore within TCS. Right. And then spent a couple of years, two and a half years in Singapore. And then I had an opportunity to join a consulting practice within TCS in Chennai. That's how I came back to Chennai. So from Mumbai to Singapore, then back to Chennai.
Mm-hmm.
And then FSS happened, right? I think it completed 6 years by then in TCS. Mm-hmm. So I thought, why not look for another opportunity? Mm-hmm. So had this opportunity of FSS coming through and then joined FSS. FSS was an interesting opportunity where I got the chance to handle the finance of all of their overseas subsidiaries.
Okay.
They were all being set up at that point in time, pretty much at a nascent stage.
Yeah.
But then there was aspects involved in terms of setting up the accounting, setting up the compliances, handling pricing, because the commercial discussions, etc., that were also part of that particular role. So it gave me exposure to pricing and legal, right?
Mm-hmm.
The head of finance who was reporting to was encouraging me to participate in a lot of legal discussions, etc. So that 4 years in FSS kind of made me more rounded as a finance person,
mm-hmm.
right? So by that time, I'd completed 10 years in the industry, and I was set up for a head finance role, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what led me to Olam. So Olam was playing the head finance kind of a role for pretty much a cost center, right? Because they had an ITS unit. The ITS unit was just about being set up in Chennai.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed a finance person to run both of these operations, reporting into the head of both the IT and ITS divisions. And also having a reporting to the finance director in Singapore, right? So
right.
Olam was taking me to that next level in terms of playing a head finance kind of a role.
Yeah.
So that was for another 2 years. So 12 years, right? And that's when ChargeBee happened. It was a casual conversation with Rajaraman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where he told me, we're looking for somebody, who can run the finance or set up the finance function for us, because the 60 people then, right?
Yeah.
It was important for them to set the rules in terms of how the finance function can play a role, right? So the casual conversation then turned into a very interesting opportunity for me, because what mm-hmm. I also learned from that conversation was ChargeBee was actually solving for finance users, right?
Yeah.
So that made it very interesting for me, right? Which is why, as part of the conversation, I told both Rajaraman and Krish that I'd also like to work very closely with the product team,
okay.
right, in terms of trying to see how, from a finance user standpoint, what knowledge base can be made available to them, right? So the good combination of setting up the finance function and also being a finance user, right,
yes.
from a product standpoint in terms of contributing to the product roadmap. So that's how ChargeBee happened. It was a very interesting opportunity, right, at that point in time, and I didn't want to miss it because that's when I think the startup ecosystem was building, right? You had Freshworks, you're doing well. ChargeBee just started off, right? So there's a lot of noise around PE investments, B2B SaaS companies and all that, right?
Yeah.
So I was happy to be part of that bandwagon. So had a interview with Krish Raman. Informal conversation led to a more formal interview.
Yeah.
And that's how I joined as a director of finance in 2016, right? August 2016 is when I joined ChargeBee.
Wow. Got it. No, I totally agree that, the startup ecosystem back then was just crazily going up, and folks were really fortunate to be a part of the early growth stories. Like you said, you joined ChargeBee in August 2016. It was pretty much around the time when they were at Series B, if I'm not wrong. And fast forward to today, they are a $3.5 billion company, In fact, I would say you folks are in the verge of an IPO direction, probably sometime down the line. So tell us about the experience within ChargeBee.
Yeah, so it's a very good experience, right? To start off with, I think, as I said, right, a couple of roles that I had to play. There was already a consultant there within ChargeBee who was taking care of the basic accounting. But then I think there was a lot of streamlining required in terms of consistent reporting, right, in terms mm-hmm. of accuracy of how books are maintained. And then also managing compliances in relation to ESOPs, setting up the legal function, because we didn't have a dedicated legal person at that point in time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So working with the outside consultants, as well as me directly getting involved in reviewing some contracts wherever the threshold was, within a certain limit.
Yeah.
I think all of those things had to be done. And then the product part of it, right, in terms of talking to the product managers, getting their doubts clarified in terms of questions that they may have very specific to finance, because our system is all about invoicing, subscription management, payments, right?
Yeah.
Receivables, revenue recognition, all of that. So it was an interesting combination of all of these different things coming together.
Yeah.
But I think what I enjoyed a lot was the space that I had, right, to take all of these steps in a structured manner, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was not like I had to do all of this in day one, right? Back then, we were just starting to, you know, grow in terms of ARR. So I think the initial year, I would say 2016, early part of 2017, was mostly spent in ensuring that there was more accuracy in terms of how we could record for the transactions, right?
Got it.
Then also taking care of the compliance part, right? Because I think the compliance piece is something which is very important, because the last thing you want is to receive some kind of a notice from, either the tax department or from any other, customer or vendor, right, in terms of not managing compliances. So that was one element that we wanted to be extra careful of.
Yeah.
And then also setting up the paperwork for ESOPs, right? Because by that time, we already had about 60 to 70 employees,
yeah,
growing to about 100, 150. So we'd promised shares. So there's some paperwork that we had to create for all of them. So all of that was what my focus was basically on, right?
Got it.
And then when 2070 happened is when I got deeply involved in terms of creating budgets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Working closely with investors, sharing regular updates to them, and all of that, right? So that's got how the journey started.
Perfect. So fast forward to 2024, we are almost 8 years now. Simple question, why do you stay?
I think every stage, right, is very different. 0 to 1M, right? 1 to 5, 5 to 10M, right? All these different eras that we have grown to, right? All different growth journeys that we have had, all have different challenges, right?
Yep.
The challenges that you had between the 0 to 1 or 1 to 5M, right? In terms of how the company was growing, very different.
Yeah.
There it was more about, as I said, right, ensuring accuracy, compliance, and all of that.
Yeah.
As you start growing, right, there are other complications that come in, right? How do you then start preparing a more accurate budget, right? How do you start publishing reports, on a quarterly basis, right? How do you start building a monthly cadence, right?
Yeah.
How do you get your accounting to the next level, right? How do you start managing different stakeholders within the company, right? How do you then start creating policies? Right. How do you start working very closely with HR? Right? So the challenges that you encounter, right, across these different journeys of growth, very, very different. And there's a lot of learning, right, to garner through that. And that's precisely the reason why you want to stay with a company like ChargeBee, right, which has gone through those stages, I would say pretty rapidly, right, since 2016 mm-hmm. to where we are in 2024. I think that phase of, by the time we thought we are settled for that 1 to 10M, right, the next level of growth journey had happened, right? So we had to quickly maneuver ourselves to address that next level of growth journey, right?
Yeah.
Like what we're going through now, right, in 2024, where I'm currently handling treasury, this is a very different journey, right? It's the learnings here are very different. Preparing a company in terms of what it takes to go public is all a different level of understanding and, learning that is, again, different by stage.
Yep.
So yeah, I think that keeps you going, right? You want to be part of each of these different learning curves.
Absolutely.
Because each one is unique by itself.
Got it. I think that's well articulated. Each stage, different learning points keeps you pushing towards who you are or what you want to define yourself as to, right? Perfect. If you were to name any few or top three reasons as to why mostly finance leaders quit sooner or just aren't part of the mission and they want to exit sooner, what would they be? Just trying to understand from the perspective of someone who's been there for about 8 years now and then seen the journey.
So one is, I think, proximity to the business, right? If you're not close to what's happening from a business standpoint in terms of understanding what metrics drive the business, what is happening, why is it happening, right? Those kind of questions, if you're not placing a close ear to, and if you're only concerned about maintaining books of accounts, just publishing reports, etc., then that journey can become pretty dry, right? And to a larger extent, that's not what is expected from a finance person. You have to be much, much closer to the business, right?
Yeah.
And as you go through these different levels, right, that's also another learning that you garner, right?
Yep.
The initial stages, you might seem a little detached, right? But then as you go through the next stages, right, the 10 to 20 M or the 20, 25 M journey,
yeah,
very clear that there is constant engagement required with all of the business leaders, understanding the pulse of the business, yeah, producing metrics that's relevant for the business, right? So as long as a finance leader doesn't correlate closely with how the business is growing,
yeah,
he's probably setting up himself for a journey which is not going to be too long.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think that's one primary reason. The other reason that also becomes important is how you set yourselves for success, right? In terms of the kind of team that you start building.
Yeah.
Right. So initially, the journey might look a little lonely because you will probably not have enough muscle power to recruit a lot of people.
Right? True that.
But as you go through those different stages, right, if you can hire smart people, right, who can do the right things for you, who can do all of the day-to-day job for you, and then you can enable yourself to go to the next level, then I think that really helps the finance leader to then grow, right? So many times what happens is sometimes because you used to being in that initial journey where you're trying to do everything by yourself,
mm-hmm,
there's a sense of insecurity that gets built, right, as you go through the subsequent stages. So that's also probably another reason why finance leaders find it hard to continue through this journey, because they want the same level of importance that was available, you know, at that initial stage.
Yeah.
And they find it hard to let it go.
Right. Got it.
So I think those are also aspects that we need to keep in mind. And then the third part, right, as you maybe we discussed in the earlier question,
mm-hmm,
is also the element of flexibility that you need to build for yourself, right, as you go through these different stages of growth. You can't be very rigid in terms of how you're thinking about your role.
Mm-hmm.
As the company grows, if required, you need to allow the right talent. You need to be flexible to allow the right talent to come in so that you can supplement those roles pretty well. Right.
True.
Those are some of the aspects that one should keep in mind.
Got it. I'm very interested about one of the points you mentioned, which is, you know, build the team, set them for success. Not at every stage would you be hands-on, building that muscle of it. Would love to zoom in on that and understand how do you go about building such winning teams, and how do you retain them for long term?
Okay. See, fortunately for us, right, I think at least from a finance standpoint, what happened was most of the recruits that we had were all from references, right?
Mm-hmm.
Somehow we were able to connect to the right people. We got the right candidate that we were able to interview for, and the right fitment for the role. That was something that we were quite fortunate to have. Initially, we were a very small team. We were just couple of us were handling things. And then we had one FP&A person coming in. He came through one known contact through Crush. Mm-hmm. We interviewed him, found him very useful, right? He had the right mindset to be part of a growing company. And quickly brought him in, right? And today he's pretty successful, right? In terms of what he's doing, he's still continuing with us, right?
Yeah.
That by itself speaks to the fact that, you know, if you've been able to retain an early stage employee for almost like 6 years now, it gives credibility to the kind of people we were able to get. And then when we went to the subsequent stage, right, we reached a stage around 2020, right, mm-hmm, where we found that we probably need to build sub functions within finance, right? We had to have a controller coming in, we had to have a FP&A lead coming in, and then we also had to build some muscle in terms of having somebody lead the legal function, right? So there again, right, we had to get the right controller, the right FP&A lead, and the legal person. Again, our contacts were pretty helpful. We spoke with some existing employees who are part of startups are doing well. Some of them were interested in being part of this journey. We got one of them in, that person referred another person, right? So I think the kind of skill sets we were looking at, Guru, at that point in time was people who had the hunger and the right attitude to work, right? Because a charge being what it is, right, gives people the environment to excel, right? So we needed people to have that mindset, to come in with an intent to actually perform well, but at the same time also be hungry for doing more.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our chief parameter that we were using, right, in terms of evaluating candidates. We were not too worried about what their background was, right, whether they were actually successful in their background. Yes, to some extent, we paid notice to that. But to a larger extent, our interview process was mostly focused on seeing the attitude part of it, right? Of course, the qualification, etc., did play a role. But largely, we wanted to see if they can be part of a team which is willing to learn and grow. So that's how all of our recruitment happened. In fact, one of the things that we always had as part of our interview process, right, was co-founder Rajaraman, you know, he also used to conduct the last interview, and his interview was more from a people standpoint in terms of measuring whether we have the right candidate for this role, right? So there's that people layer in terms of the behavioral aspects, which were also taken care as part of any person that we're trying to recruit. And I think that was a very important process that we had, right? So for all of the recruits, we had somebody like Rajaraman, who's a co-founder, coming in and interviewing those candidates. It's a good filter to have, because many times you can have finance people coming in and they might be very traditional in their thinking. They might be very closed in their thinking, right? This is quite possible for a finance role. But having that filter towards the end was also something that enabled us to ensure that we had people with the right mindset coming in.
Got it. Great. Now we're going to zoom into a few milestones within ChargeBee. Starting with 2022, when pandemic was just behind us, and you know, companies were actually working on a cost-cutting effort, operating lean, but ChargeBee probably didn't get the memo. They were on a different highway. We went on to raise another $250 million, get into the $3.5 billion valuation, and did an acquisition spree, right? Revlog, Brightback, and Numbers, to be precise. Take us through that. What was the ideology behind it, and how do you even suggest such a thing for other businesses?
Again, I think when the pandemic hit us, right, and we all went into that work from home mode, from a larger perspective, right, to be honest, we were quite skeptical, right, in terms of how things will play out, because there were all of this news coming in terms of, you know, how companies were going through different curves, right. Going up, coming down, flattening, and all of that, right? So we had also mentally prepared ourselves for those models, right? In fact, we had various versions of our own performance, right? In terms of, you know, one model being conservative, one being slightly optimistic, right? And the other being something that we can, you know, perform according to what we had agreed as budgets, right?
Yeah.
So mentally, that preparation mode was there. In terms of things not working out, given the fact that the pandemic was pretty much, you know, affecting companies across the globe to a larger extent equally. Right? But what we found that worked well for us, right, because a lot of them, a lot of the companies went into that work from home mode. There were a few businesses which started doing extremely well, right? Especially if it was this e-learning side of it, right? Those kind of businesses started doing well. And there was a heavy dose of subscription businesses that were emerging because of the pandemic coming in, right? And a lot of people starting to work from remote.
Wow.
I think that combined with the fact that we already had a lot of customers who were, you know, in that early stage growing along with us, enabled us to actually beat our numbers, right? So we did extremely well during the pandemic. When we came out of the pandemic, our numbers were like growing, you know, almost double, right, in terms of how we were doing year on year. That paved the way for us to then become extremely confident in terms of how well we can execute, right? If you can execute well in an environment like this, right, obviously when things turn to our favor, it's only going to get better, right? And I think that's what pretty much paved the way for us to go for another round of funding. I think the investors also saw value in terms of, you know, what we were bringing to the table, how well we were able to perform, right, despite the environment not essentially being completely in our favor. I think that kind of fueled the entire process, you know, of growth, funding, and our own ability to then think through in terms of, you know, why we can't acquire companies, right? We can probably acquire at least two or three companies and then have those companies grow with us, right? So I think it kind of came, all of it came well for us together. One, because of our own way of how we've executed well, right, in terms of building customer confidence. And then some businesses going through that, you know, a change, right, in terms of shifting to a a more work for home kind of a model, e-learning businesses thriving, right? So that combination is kind of what was the sweet spot for us.
Perfect. Got it. I think the acquisitions were also very tactical in terms of building the consolidated subscription building platform for any sort of business, right? So what was, apart from the traditional finance efforts, right, you being also a product guide or a product consultant, what were suggestions that you did in terms of those acquisitions?
See, my role in the acquisitions was more in terms of the evaluation and, working closely with Krishnaraman, and then when there's an opportunity available, talking to the investors in terms of justifying our calculations and all of that, mm-hmm. right? See, one thing that was obviously emerging was we built a good billing model, a billing mm-hmm. subscription billing model, right? We obviously wanted to build adjacencies around it, right? And if you look at all of the acquisitions that we made, one was on the receivable side, right? Because obviously receivables is connected with billing. The other one was with revenue recognition, which is more about, the US-based compliances, ESC 606 and all of that. And the third one was on churn, retention, etc. So the philosophy was very clear. I think the philosophy was to build, adjacencies. And to build these adjacencies, what was the acquisition model that we had to think about?
Okay.
Obviously, subscription billing as a category was emerging, right? And we were seeing that happening through our competitors, etc.
Yeah.
So these acquisitions happened in a very structured manner, where there were specific conversations that were initiated, right? Those companies were looking out for the right partners with which they can, probably work long term, and we were also looking for the right adjacencies that we can build through. So, I think that was the mix that was coming together, right? And our role was to ensure that as a company, as a billing company, as a subscription billing company, was to embrace these new acquisitions and help them grow, right, as companies, mm-hmm. as individual categories, and also overall in terms of embracing the subscription billing category as a whole.
Yeah.
So, that's how I would summarize the way we went about the acquisition piece.
Got it. Great. Fast forwarding to probably a year or two, the whole world was struggling in terms of layoffs. It was very tough. Every single organization struggled, right? But massive respect to the ChargeBee initiative, the outplacement initiative. How did you folks go about dealing with it? Any sort of learning materials or best practices that you would guide for organizations? Not that it's going to repeat, but it's always great to be prepared.
Right. I think, I'll probably give you one takeaway from that entire exercise, right, which is something mm-hmm. that both as an insider, as an outsider, I could really mm-hmm. find it resonating very well, mm-hmm. is the transparency with which we dealt with that entire process, right?
Okay.
I think it was pretty much known to the entire world that every company is going to go through this, right? At some point in time, it was, anybody's guess, right? If this company is not going to do this, or they're going to take a different path, so
yeah,
it was inevitable to go through that phase, and that was evident from what we actually ended up doing. But I think the key to that entire process, right, both from a learning perspective as well as what we did very well, was to give the right amount of transparency to the employees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Both employees were retained and as employees were laid off. I think that was well appreciated across the board. Right. So, if you would ask me what is a key learning, I'll probably say transparency, right? And what we did well was transparency, right? So, because that's end of the day, that's what employees want, right? You don't want somebody getting promoted, and we see a lot of companies going through that. Somebody getting promoted, and then the next day they get to hear that they're being laid off, right?
Yeah.
Which means there's something amiss, right, in terms of how that entire process is working, right? We never had that kind of a scenario where we promoted an employee and the next day we've said, okay, you're laid off, right? I think we kind of orchestrated that entire activity of, letting employees go in a manner which is professional and which is completely transparent.
Right? Got it.
So very few people had any comms on it, right? In terms of coming back, giving us, an aggressive feedback. I don't think I heard anything, right? Probably there have been one or two, not saying it was completely not there, but that's that kind of proves to the fact that, you know, that how well it was orchestrated.
True that. Okay. So we've now talked about a high and a low, and I just want to take your thoughts on how do finance leaders stay calm during this crest trough oscillations that keep happening? How do you stay afloat? How do you stay on the ground, influenced by any of this, and then make real-time decisions? Because at the end of the day, you are expected to make a very rational decision. So how do you go about doing it when you go through such phases?
Okay, I'll probably tell you what I learned from, right? Because by the time we waited to this pandemic, right, when we started this pandemic, we had a fractional CFO on board, right, who was working very closely with me and was assisting me in terms of the way we need to operate, right, from a finance standpoint. And then when the pandemic was over and we started again, you know, back to where we are today, we recruited the full-time CFO, right?
Yeah.
So I had the advantage of working with both the fractional CFO and the current CFO as part of charges. And being on the sidelines, right, in terms of what I learned from them was being prepared for what is to come through, right? Is extremely important in such scenarios, right? Now, whether it happens or it doesn't happen is a different thing, right?
Yeah.
But I think the preparation that it takes, building the scenarios, ensuring that there is sufficient provisioning for your prime assets, right? Be it cash, be it, your employees, etc. Those are all of prime importance when you're going through this kind of a phase.
Got it.
I think if you assume that, you know, these things will not hit us, irrespective of how well we are doing, then probably, you know, we're building a blind spot for ourselves, right, in terms of remaining ignorant.
Correct.
That, I think, was something which is very key. And I think the other thing I also learned being on the sidelines was the constant communication on some of these aspects, right? Constantly talking to the teams, even within finance, right? Because a lot of people, even within finance, have apprehensions, right, in terms of how some of these things will play out. So constant communication internally within the teams, and then also to the external stakeholders, you know, different departments, etc., giving them comfort on, you know, why we are in a good position, you know, how our balance sheet is stacked up, right? Giving them some financial knowledge is kind of prime importance when companies go through this phase. Because until then, the employees are not too concerned about your cash balance. They don't know, theoretically, they know to some extent what valuations mean, but practically, right, they have a real understanding of how valuations work. But when something like this suddenly hits them, they're concerned about their own ESOPs that they're holding, their own shares that they're holding.
Yeah.
They're hearing a lot of external noise, right, in terms of how other companies are going through such difficulties. So there's something that's needed to kind of calm them down, right, keep them at where they are, right? Not by giving them or advising them or telling them things which are incorrect, but by telling them things which are realistic, right, and which are factual.
Yeah.
And that, I think, becomes a very important function that a finance leader can play.
Right?
One is communicating that internally within the finance team, and then also communicating it to, important leaders across the org. And so that was something that I learned it was very insightful for me when being on the sidelines of both of these leaders worked with.
Got it. I think transparency, like, that's one of the biggest takeaways, transparency and building that communication within the organization where there's a free flow of information. Folks get to know what's happening day in, day out. I think, yeah.
Correct.
Totally.
Absolutely. And then also giving them some education, right, in terms of what these numbers actually look like, right? Because many times people hear about EBITDA, they talk about burn, right? This is all like some terminologies that people get to understand.
Correct.
But what these terminologies actually mean, right? I think it becomes an interesting inflection point to educate people on these terminologies.
True.
In fact, I remember in 2021, we had deliberately conducted a lot of internal training sessions. In fact, one of those sessions, which I also participated in, was part of conducting that session, was on terminology is relevant to the finance for non-finance managers, right? This was a session that we conducted. For all of the non-finance folks, what are the finance terminologies that you have to understand? Because end of the day, every employee in the company is dealing with finance in some form or the manner, right? Either in terms of receiving his salary check or in terms of getting his reimbursements process, right? Or getting his ESOP paperwork done. So it's inevitable for an employee within an organization to say that he is not connected to the finance function. Right. So I think finance for non-finance managers was something that was a good tool to educate people about, educate employees in terms of what all of this is about, right? What is EBITDA? What is the rule of 40? You know, what is cash burn, right? All of this.
Absolutely. I think more than that, not just these three parameters, now that they are also working with the finance leaders in terms of implementing the solution and everything, it further proves the point that the understanding of finance is mandatory and those basic information or intellect needs to be present there.
Absolutely. And people are also seeking for it, right? I think when you go through this kind of a downturn, right, people want to know what their assets are valued today. That's when they start, they want to at least understand what is exercise price, what is strike rate, right? All of these different concepts go through their mind. Until then, they have a rough idea in terms of, or a vague idea in terms of what these terminologies mean. Which is why I think it's important for finance leaders to be proactive there, right? And then go and let people know that this is what all of this means. And then count on their nose, make them feel more at home, right? So,
Got it. And building this culture of staying calm across your team, I'm guessing it also drives through how you set an example for them. Or what would you recommend as the...
I think it percolates, right? If your leader is symbolizing that, right? As I said, right? The leaders that I had a chance to work with pretty much symbolized that, right? So all it had for me to do was to percolate it to the next level, right? So I think that's how it works. If at the top, that calmness doesn't prevail, it's when it becomes a challenge, then it becomes a two-way street, right, where you're trying to negotiate. But I think if you have the right leaders guiding you, then it becomes easier.
Got it. Great. So now we are on to a segment where I'm going to ask you your personal opinions or the things that you're really, the predictions, I would call it. So for the finance industry in the next 5 years, what is one thing that you're very bullish about? Is there any bullish prediction from Karthik for the next five years in the finance industry?
So when you say finance industry, you're referring to finance?
The tech side of finance.
Oh, the tech side of finance. See, I think there is a lot of noise about artificial intelligence, AI, right? In terms of how that's going to play a significant role. Right. And I think it's no different for finance as well, right? Just that at what layers it's going to play that role, I mean, in terms of AI for finance is something that where there'll be a nuance, right? Like, for example, some of the repetitive tasks that finance have been used to doing, right? Like, for example, matching transactions, recording transactions, reconciling transactions, etc. To a large extent, we're already seeing automation playing a role there. But I think AI will definitely pull its weight there, right, in terms of ensuring that some of these things become more streamlined, right? So, which means anything which is repetitive, anything which can be, given as a command or as an instruction, right, for being processed routinely, you're going to see AI play a significant role for the finance teams as well, right? A lot of the back office functions today, right, exist in that mode, right? So I see a great interplay of AI there in terms of supplementing some of the efforts, right? Obviously, there is context that is still required, right? In terms of, orchestrating these instructions accurately. But there's definitely going to be a huge AI element coming in there, a technology element coming in there, which is where I think the services piece will become very interesting for the finance leaders, right? How much can they augment, how much of intellect can they supplement, right, to these tools is an area which will become very interesting. There are certain areas where it will be difficult for AI to actually penetrate because let's assume that you're looking at financial statements, right? Financial statement analysis is something that you can still take the help of AI. But then interpreting accounting standards, right?
Yep.
Those are things where you still need a lot of intellect, right?
True.
So I think the intellectual game is probably going to get one level higher. The strategic aspect will be there to stay, right? I think it's the really repetitive tasks in terms of reconciling, recording, etc., which you'll probably see a lot of AI coming in and consuming that particular aspect. But then again, there is, still that services play in terms of training these tools, right, to perform these tasks. So I'm assuming the near term, those opportunities will also get created.
Got it. And is ChargeBee leveraging any of the AI tools, especially in the finance space? What's your plan for AI within ChargeBee?
So I think we're already doing some, internally within ChargeBee, we're trying to see if, our engineering teams can, leverage for some of the codes that they're writing, etc. And at some point in time, we'll also try and see, for some of the reporting that we have within our tool, right, how we can supplement AI, right? So yes, there's definitely a roadmap for AI for us as well, right, in terms of how we can, all of the repetitive tasks, how is it that we can enable
it
ourselves internally as well as our customers.
Got it. And what sort of challenges do you think you would have, especially, I understand that the service part of it is going to be challenging. Do you foresee any sort of other challenges coming up in the near future with regards to implementing AI within the finance department?
As I said, context is very important, right? And unless we set the right context in terms of how we want to use it, we're probably setting it up for failure, right?
True.
So constantly reviewing the roles, trying to understand, how behavioral patterns are changing within the organization, then fine-tuning that to train the tool better are very, very important aspects, right? Because with the business is dynamic, right? The finance function is also expected to play a dynamic role, right? So you can't, go with this vision that things will remain where they are, right?
Yeah.
Enabling that flexibility for systems to evolve is an important ingredient that has to be packaged in, right?
True.
As we go through this journey.
Got it. I think that was fantastically put. Great. So those were the questions, Karthik. Really wonderful having you on the show. Thank you so much for answering the questions and sharing some wisdom with the community.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Guru. It was great talking to you. Thank you so much for the opportunity provided.